should be remembered that all large-scale democracies until the 20th century limited political rights to a small circle of relatively wealthy men. Democracy is never a matter of all or nothing. It is a continuum, and late 16th century Poles and Lithuanians explored previously unknown regions of that continuum. Aside from electing its king, Poland-Lithuania had an elected parliament, the same, that approved or blocked new legislation and had the power to veto royal decisions on taxation and foreign affairs. Moreover, citizens enjoyed a list of inviolable rights, such as freedom of assembly and freedom of religion. In the late 16th and early 17th centuries, when most of Europe suffered from bitter religious conflicts and persecutions, Poland-Lithuania was a tolerant haven, where Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Lutherans, Calvinists, Jews, and even Muslims coexisted in relative harmony. In 1616, more than 100 mosques functioned in the Commonwealth. In the end, however, the Polish-Lithuanian experiment in decentralization proved to be impractical. The country was Europe's second largest state, after Russia, covering almost 1 million square kilometers and including most of the territory of today's Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. It lacked the information, communication, and education systems necessary to hold a meaningful political conversation between Polish aristocrats, Lithuanian noblemen, Ukrainian Cossacks, and Jewish rabbis spread from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. Its self-correcting mechanisms were also too costly, paralyzing the power of the central government. In particular, every single Sejm deputy was given the right to veto all parliamentary legislation, which led to political deadlock. The combination of a large and diverse polity with a weak center proved fatal. The Commonwealth was torn apart by centrifugal forces, and its pieces were then divided between the centralized autocracies of Russia, Austria, and Prussia. The Dutch experiment fared better. In some ways, the Dutch United Provinces were even less centralized than the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, since they lacked a monarch, and were a union of 7 autonomous provinces, which were in turn made up of self-governing towns and cities. This decentralized nature is reflected in the plural form of how the country was known abroad. The Netherlands in English, Les Pays-Bas in French, Los Países Bajos in Spanish, and so on. However, taken together, the United Provinces were 25 times smaller in landmass than Poland-Lithuania, and possessed a much better information, communication, and education system that tied its constituent parts closely together. The United Provinces also pioneered a new information technology with a big future. In June 1618, a pamphlet titled Courant uit Italien, Deutschland, etc. appeared in Amsterdam. As its title indicated, it carried news from the Italian peninsula, the German lands, and other places. There was nothing remarkable about this particular pamphlet, except that new issues were published in the following weeks too. They appeared regularly until 1670, when the Courant uit Italien, Deutschland, etc. merged with other serial pamphlets into the Amsterdamische Courant, which appeared until 1903, when it was merged into De Telegraaf, the Netherlands' largest newspaper to this day. The newspaper is a periodic pamphlet, and it was different from earlier one-off pamphlets because it had a much stronger self-correcting mechanism. Unlike one-off publications, a weekly or daily newspaper has a chance to correct its mistakes and an incentive to do so in order to win the public's trust. Shortly after the Courant uit Italien, Deutschland etc. appeared, a competing newspaper titled Tidingen uit verschiedene Quartieren, Tidings from Various Quarters, made its debut. The Courant was generally considered more reliable because it tried to check its stories before publishing them, and because the Tidingen was accused of being overly patriotic and reporting only news favorable to the Netherlands. Nevertheless, both newspapers survived, because, as one reader explained, one can always find something in one newspaper that is not available in the other. In the following decades, dozens of additional newspapers were published in the Netherlands, which became Europe's journalistic hub. Newspapers that succeeded in gaining widespread trust became the architects and mouthpieces of public opinion. They created a far more informed and engaged public, which changed the nature of politics, first in the Netherlands and later around the world. The political influence of newspapers was so crucial that newspaper editors often became political leaders. Jean-Paul Marat rose to power in revolutionary France by founding and editing L'Ami du Peuple. Eduard Bernstein helped create Germany's Social Democratic Party by editing Der Sozialdemokrat. Vladimir Lenin's most important position before becoming Soviet dictator was editor of Iskra. And Benito Mussolini rose to fame first as a socialist journalist in Avanti and later as founder and editor of the firebrand right-wing paper Il Popolo d'Italia. Newspapers played a crucial role in the formation of early modern democracies, like the United Provinces in the Low Countries, the United Kingdom in the British Isles, and the United States in North America. As the names themselves indicate, these were not city-states like ancient Athens and Rome, but amalgams of different regions glued together in part by this new information technology. For example, when on December 6, 1825, President John Quincy Adams gave his first annual message to the U.S. Congress, the text of the address and summaries of the main points were published over the next weeks by newspapers from Boston to New Orleans. At the time, hundreds of newspapers and magazines were being published in the United States. Adams declared his administration's intentions of initiating numerous federal projects, ranging from the construction of roads to the founding of an astronomical observatory, which he poetically named Lighthouse of the Skies. His speech ignited a fierce public debate, much of it conducted in print, between those who supported such big government plans as essential for the development of the United States, and many who preferred a small government approach and saw Adams's plans as federal overreach and an encroachment on states' rights. Northern supporters of the small government camp complained that it was unconstitutional for the federal government to tax the citizens of richer states in order to build roads in poorer states. Southerners feared that a federal government that claims the power to build a lighthouse of the skies in their backyard may one day claim the power to free their slaves, too. Adams was accused of harboring dictatorial ambitions, while the erudition and sophistication of his speech were criticized as elitist and disconnected from ordinary Americans. The public debates over the 1825 message to Congress dealt a severe blow to the reputation of the Adams administration and helped pave the way to Adams' subsequent electoral defeat. In the 1828 presidential elections, Adams lost to Andrew Jackson, a rich slaveholding planter from Tennessee, who was successfully rebranded in numerous newspaper columns as the Man of the People, and who claimed that the previous elections were in fact stolen by Adams and by the corrupt Washington elites. Newspapers of the time were, of course, still slow and limited compared with the mass media of today. Newspapers travelled at the pace of a horse or sailboat, and relatively few people read them regularly. There were no newsstands or street vendors, so people had to buy subscriptions, which were expensive. Average annual subscriptions cost around 1 week's wages for a skilled journeyman. As a result, the total number of subscribers to all US newspapers in 1830 is estimated at just 78,000. Since some subscribers were associations or businesses rather than individuals, and since every copy was probably read by several people, it seems reasonable to assume that regular newspaper readership numbered in the hundreds of thousands. But millions more people rarely, if ever, read newspapers. No wonder that American democracy in those days was a limited affair. and the domain of wealthy white men. In the 1824 elections that brought Adams to power, 1.3 million Americans were theoretically eligible to vote out of an adult population of about 5 million, or around 25%. Only 352,780 people, 7% of the total adult population, actually made use of their right. Adams didn't even win a majority of those who voted. Owing to the quirks of the US electoral system, he became president thanks to the support of just 113,122 voters, or not much more than 2% of adults and 1% of the total population. In Britain at the same time, only about 400,000 people were eligible to vote for Parliament, or around 6% of the adult population. Moreover, 30% of parliamentary seats were not even contested. You may wonder whether we are talking about democracies at all. At a time when the United States had more slaves than voters, more than 1.5 million Americans were enslaved in the early 1820s. Was the United States really a democracy? This is a question of definitions. As with the late 16th century Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, so also with the early 19th century United States, democracy is a relative term. As noted earlier, democracy and autocracy aren't absolutes. They are part of a continuum. In the early 19th century, out of all large-scale human societies, the United States was probably the closest to the democratic end of the continuum. Giving 25% of adults the right to vote doesn't sound like much today, but in 1824 that was a far higher percentage than in the Tsarist, Ottoman or Chinese empires, in which nobody had the right to vote. Besides, as emphasized throughout this chapter, voting is not the only thing that counts. An even more important reason to consider the United States in 1824 a democracy is that compared with most other polities of its day, the new country possessed much stronger self-correcting mechanisms. The founding fathers were inspired by ancient Rome, witness the Senate and the Capitol in Washington, and they were well aware that the Roman Republic eventually turned into an autocratic empire. They feared that some American Caesar would do something similar to their republic and constructed multiple overlapping self-correcting mechanisms known as the system of checks and balances. One of these was a free press. In ancient Rome, the self-correcting mechanisms stopped functioning as the republic enlarged its territory and population. In the United States, modern information technology combined with freedom of the press helped the self-correcting mechanisms survive even as the country extended from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It was these self-correcting mechanisms that gradually enabled the United States to expand the franchise, abolish slavery, and turn itself into a more inclusive democracy. As noted in Chapter 2, the Founding Fathers committed enormous mistakes, such as endorsing slavery and denying women the vote, but they also provided the tools for their descendants to correct these mistakes. That was their greatest legacy. The 20th century. Mass democracy, but also mass totalitarianism. Printed newspapers were just the first harbinger of the mass media age. During the 19th and 20th centuries, a long list of new communication and transportation technologies, such as the telegraph, the telephone, television, radio, train, steamship, and airplane, supercharged the power of mass media. When Demosthenes gave a public speech in Athens around 350 BCE, it was aimed primarily at the limited audience actually present in the Athenian Agora. When John Quincy Adams gave his first annual message in 1825, his words spread at the pace of a horse. When Abraham Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863, telegraphs, locomotives, and steamships conveyed his words much faster throughout the Union and beyond. The very next day, the New York Times had already reprinted the speech in full, as had numerous other newspapers from the Portland Daily Press in Maine to the Ottumwa Courier in Iowa. As befitting a democracy with strong self-correcting mechanisms in place, the president's speech sparked a lively conversation rather than universal applause. Most newspapers lauded it, but some expressed their doubts. The Chicago Times wrote on November 20 that the cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of President Lincoln. The Patriot and Union, a local newspaper in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, also blasted the silly remarks of the president, and hoped that the veil of oblivion shall be dropped over them and that they shall be no more repeated or thought of. Though the country was in the midst of a civil war, journalists were free to publicly criticize and even ridicule the president. Fast forward a century, and things really picked up speed. For the first time in history, new technologies allowed masses of people spread over vast swathes of territory to connect in real time. In 1960, about 70 million Americans, 39% of the total population, dispersed over the North American continent and beyond, watched the Nixon-Kennedy presidential debates live on television, with millions more listening on the radio. The only effort viewers and listeners had to make was to press a button while sitting in their homes. Large-scale democracy had now become feasible. Millions of people separated by thousands of kilometers could conduct informed and meaningful public debates about the rapidly evolving issues of the day. By 1960, all adult Americans were theoretically eligible to vote, and close to 70 million, about 64% of the electorate, actually did so. Though millions of blacks and other disenfranchised groups were prevented from voting through various voter suppression schemes. As always, we should beware of technological determinism and of concluding that the rise of mass media led to the rise of large-scale democracy. Mass media made large-scale democracy possible rather than inevitable. And it also made possible other types of regimes. In particular, the new information technologies of the modern age opened the door for large-scale totalitarian regimes. Like Nixon and Kennedy, Stalin and Khrushchev could say something over the radio and be heard instantaneously by hundreds of millions of people from Vladivostok to Kaliningrad. They could also receive daily reports by phone and telegraph from millions of secret police agents and informers. If a newspaper in Vladivostok or Kaliningrad wrote that the Supreme Leader's latest speech was silly, as happened to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, then everyone involved, from the editor-in-chief to the typesetters, would likely have received a visit from the KGB. A Brief History of Totalitarianism. Totalitarian systems assume their own infallibility and seek total control over the totality of people's lives. Before the invention of the telegraph, radio, and other modern information technology, large-scale totalitarian regimes were impossible. Roman emperors, Abbasid caliphs, and Mongol khans were often ruthless autocrats who believed they were infallible. But they did not have the apparatus necessary to impose totalitarian control over large societies. To understand this, we should first clarify the difference between totalitarian regimes and less extreme autocratic regimes. In an autocratic network, there are no legal limits on the will of the ruler, but there are nevertheless a lot of technical limits. In a totalitarian network, many of these technical limits are absent. For example, in autocratic regimes like the Roman Empire, the Abbasid Empire, and the Mongol Empire, rulers could usually execute any person who displeased them, and if some law got in their way, they could ignore or change the law. The Emperor Nero arranged the murder of his mother Agrippina, and his wife, Octavia, and forced his mentor, Seneca, to commit suicide. Nero also executed or exiled some of the most respected and powerful Roman aristocrats merely for voicing dissent or telling jokes about him. While autocratic rulers like Nero could execute anyone who did or said something that displeased them, they couldn't know what most people in their empire were doing or saying. Theoretically, Nero could issue an order that any person in the Roman Empire who criticized or insulted the emperor must be severely punished. Yet there were no technical means for implementing such an order. Roman historians like Tacitus portray Nero as a bloodthirsty tyrant who instigated an unprecedented reign of terror. But this was a very limited type of terror. Although he executed or exiled a number of family members, aristocrats, and senators within his orbit, ordinary Romans in the city slums and provincials in distant towns like Jerusalem and Londinium could speak their mind much more freely. Modern totalitarian regimes like the Stalinist USSR instigated terror on an altogether different scale. Totalitarianism is the attempt to control what every person throughout the country is doing and saying every moment of the day, and potentially even what every person is thinking and feeling. Nero might have dreamed about such powers, but he lacked the means to realize them. Given the limited tax base of the agrarian Roman economy, Nero couldn't employ many people in his service. He could place informers at the dinner parties of Roman senators, but he had only about 10,000 imperial administrators and 350,000 soldiers to control the rest of the empire, and he lacked the technology to communicate with them swiftly. Nero and his fellow emperors had an even bigger problem ensuring the loyalty of the administrators and soldiers they did have on their payroll. No Roman emperor was ever toppled by a democratic revolution like the ones that deposed Louis XVI, Nicolae Ceausescu, or Hosni Mubarak. Instead, dozens of emperors were assassinated or deposed by their own generals, officials, bodyguards, or family members. Nero himself was overthrown by a revolt of the governor of Hispania, Galba. 6 months later, Galba was ousted by Otho, the governor of Lusitania. Within 3 months, Otho was deposed by Vitellius, commander of the Rhine army. Vitellius lasted about 8 months before he was defeated and killed by Vespasian, commander of the army in Judea. Being killed by a rebellious subordinate was the biggest occupational hazard not just for Roman emperors, but for almost all pre-modern autocrats. Emperors, caliphs, shahs, and kings found it a huge challenge to keep their subordinates in check. Rulers consequently focused their attention on controlling the military and the taxation system. Roman emperors had the authority to interfere in the local affairs of any province or city, and they sometimes exercised that authority, but this was usually done in response to a specific petition sent by a local community or official, rather than as part of some empire-wide totalitarian 5-year plan. If you were a mule driver in Pompeii, or a shepherd in Roman Britain, Nero didn't want to control your daily routines or police the jokes you told. As long as you paid your taxes and didn't resist the legions, that was good enough for Nero. Sparta and Chin. Some scholars claim that despite the technological difficulties, there were attempts to establish totalitarian regimes in ancient times. The most common example cited is Sparta. According to this interpretation, Spartans were ruled by a totalitarian regime that micromanaged every aspect of their lives, from whom they married to what they ate. However, while the Spartan regime was certainly draconian, it actually included several self-correcting mechanisms that prevented power from being monopolized by a single person or faction. Political authority was divided between 2 kings, 5 ephors, senior magistrates, 28 members of the Gerousia Council, and the Popular Assembly. Important decisions, such as whether to go to war, often involved fierce public debates. Moreover, irrespective of how we evaluate the nature of Sparta's regime, it is clear that the same technological limitations that confined ancient Athenian democracy to a single city also limited the scope of the Spartan political experiment. After winning the Peloponnesian War, Sparta installed military garrisons and pro-Spartan governments in numerous Greek cities, requiring them to follow its lead in foreign policy and sometimes also pay tribute. But unlike the USSR after World War II, Sparta after the Peloponnesian War did not try to expand or export its system. Sparta couldn't construct an information network big and dense enough to control the lives of ordinary people in every Greek town and village. A much more ambitious totalitarian project might have been launched by the Qin dynasty in ancient China, 221 to 206 BCE. After defeating all the other warring states, the Qin ruler, Qin Shi Huang, controlled a huge empire with tens of millions of subjects who belonged to numerous different ethnic groups, spoke diverse languages, and were loyal to various local traditions and elites. To cement its power, the victorious Qin regime tried to dismantle any regional powers that might challenge its authority. It confiscated the lands and wealth of local aristocrats and forced regional elites to move to the imperial capital of Xiangyang, thereby separating them from their power base and monitoring them more easily. The Qin regime also embarked on a ruthless campaign of centralization and homogenization. It created a new simplified script to be used throughout the empire and standardized coinage, weights, and measurements. It built a road network radiating out of Xiangyang with standardized rest houses, relay stations, and military checkpoints. People needed written permits in order to enter or leave the capital region or frontier zones. Even the width of axles was standardized to ensure that carts and chariots could run in the same ruts. Every action, from tilling fields to getting married, was supposed to serve some military need, and the type of military discipline that Rome reserved for the legions was imposed by the Qin on the entire population. The envisioned reach of this system can be exemplified by one Qin law that specified the punishment an official faced if he neglected a granary under his supervision. The law discusses the number of rat holes in the granary that would warrant fining or berating the official. For 3 or more rat holes, the fine is the purchase of 1 shield for the army, and for 2 or fewer, the responsible official is berated. 3 mouse holes are equal to 1 rat hole. To facilitate this totalitarian system, the Qin attempted to create a militarized social order. Every male subject had to belong to a 5-man unit. These units were aggregated into larger formations, from local hamlets, li, through cantons, zhang, and counties, xian, all the way to the large imperial commanderies, jun. People were forbidden to change their residence without permit, to the extent that guests could not even stay overnight at a friend's house without proper identification and authorization. Every Qin male subject was also given a rank, just as every soldier in an army has a rank. Obedience to the state resulted in promotion to higher ranks, which brought with it economic and legal privileges, while disobedience could result in demotion or punishment. People in each formation were supposed to supervise one another, and if any individual committed some misdeed, all could be punished for it. Anyone who failed to report a criminal, even their own relatives, would be killed. Those who reported crimes were rewarded with higher ranks and other perks. It is highly questionable to what extent the regime managed to implement all these totalitarian measures. Bureaucrats writing documents in a government office often invent elaborate rules and regulations which then turn out to be impractical. Did conscientious government officials really go around the entire Qin Empire counting rat holes in every granary? Were peasants in every remote mountain hamlet really organized into five-man squads? Probably not. Nevertheless, the Qin Empire outdid other ancient empires in its totalitarian ambitions. The Qin regime even tried to control what its subjects were thinking and feeling. During the Warring States period, Chinese thinkers were relatively free to develop myriad ideologies and philosophies, but the Qin adopted the doctrine of legalism as the official state ideology. Legalism posited that humans were naturally greedy, cruel, and egotistical. It emphasized the need for strict control, argued that punishments and rewards were the most effective means of control, and insisted that state power not be curtailed by any moral consideration. Might was right, and the good of the state was the supreme good. The Qin prescribed other philosophies, such as Confucianism and Taoism, which believed humans were more altruistic and which emphasized the importance of virtue rather than violence. Books espousing such soft views were banned, as well as books that contradicted the official Qin version of history. When one scholar argued that Qin Shi Huang should emulate the founder of the ancient Zhou dynasty and decentralize state power, the Qin chief minister, Li Si, countered that scholars should stop criticizing present-day institutions by idealizing the past. The regime ordered the confiscation of all books that romanticized antiquity or otherwise criticized the Qin. Such problematic texts were stored in the imperial library and could be studied only by official scholars. The Qin Empire was probably the most ambitious totalitarian experiment in human history prior to the modern age, and its scale and intensity would prove to be its ruin. The attempt to regiment tens of millions of people along military lines and to monopolize all resources for military purposes led to severe economic problems, wastefulness, and popular resentment. The regime's draconian laws, along with its hostility to regional elites and its voracious appetite for taxes and recruits, fanned the flames of this resentment even further. Meanwhile, the limited resources of an ancient agrarian society couldn't support all the bureaucrats and soldiers that the Qin needed to contain this resentment, and the low efficiency of their information technology made it impossible to control every town and village from distant Xiangyang. Not surprisingly, in 209 BCE, a series of revolts broke out, led by regional elites, disgruntled commoners, and even some of the empire's own newly minted officials. According to one account, the first serious revolt started when a group of conscripted peasants sent to work in the frontier zone were delayed by rain and flooding. They feared they would be executed for this dereliction of duty and felt they had nothing to lose. They were quickly joined by numerous other rebels. Just 15 years after reaching the apogee of power, the Qin Empire collapsed under the weight of its totalitarian ambitions, splintering into 18 kingdoms. After several years of war, a new dynasty, the Han, reunited the empire. But the Han then adopted a more realistic, less draconian attitude. Han emperors were certainly autocratic, but they were not totalitarian. They did not recognize any limits on their authority, but they did not try to micromanage everyone's lives. Instead of following legalist ideas of surveillance and control, the Han turned to Confucian ideas of encouraging people to act loyally and responsibly out of inner moral convictions. Like their contemporaries in the Roman Empire, Han emperors sought to control only some aspects of society from the center, while leaving considerable autonomy to provincial aristocrats and local communities. Due largely to the limitations imposed by the available information technology, pre-modern large-scale polities like the Roman and Han empires gravitated toward non-totalitarian autocracy. Full-blown totalitarianism might have been dreamed about by the likes of the Qin, but its implementation had to wait for the development of modern technology. The Totalitarian Trinity. Just as modern technology enabled large-scale democracy, it also made large-scale totalitarianism possible. Beginning in the 19th century, the rise of industrial economies allowed governments to employ many more administrators, and new information technologies, such as the telegraph and radio, made it possible to quickly connect and supervise all these administrators. This facilitated an unprecedented concentration of information and power for those who dreamed about such things. When the Bolsheviks seized control of Russia after the 1917 revolution, they were driven by exactly such a dream. The Bolsheviks craved unlimited power because they believed they had a messianic mission. Marx taught that for millennia, all human societies were dominated by corrupt elites who oppressed the people. The Bolsheviks claimed they knew how to finally end all oppression and create a perfectly just society on Earth. But to do so, they had to overcome numerous enemies and obstacles, which, in turn, required all the power they could get. They refused to countenance any self-correcting mechanisms that might question either their vision or their methods. Like the Catholic Church, the Bolshevik Party was convinced that, though its individual members might err, the party itself was always right. Belief in their own infallibility led the Bolsheviks to destroy Russia's nascent democratic institutions, like elections, independent courts, the free press, and opposition parties, and to create a one-party totalitarian regime. Bolshevik totalitarianism did not start with Stalin. It was evident from the very first days of the revolution. It stemmed from the doctrine of party infallibility, rather than from the personality of Stalin. In the 1930s and 1940s, Stalin perfected the totalitarian system he inherited. The Stalinist network was composed of three main branches. First, there was the governmental apparatus of state ministries, regional administrations, and regular Red Army units, which in 1939 comprised 1.6 million civilian officials and 1.9 million soldiers. Second, there was the apparatus of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and its ubiquitous party cells, which in 1939 included 2.4 million party members. Third, there was the secret police. First known as the Cheka, in Stalin's days it was called the OGPU, NKVD, and MGB. And after Stalin's death, it morphed into the KGB. Its post-Soviet successor organization has been known since 1995 as the FSB. In 1937, the NKVD had 270,000 agents and millions of informers. The three branches operated in parallel. Just as democracy is maintained by having overlapping self-correcting mechanisms that keep each other in check, modern totalitarianism created overlapping surveillance mechanisms that keep each other in order. The governor of a Soviet province was constantly watched by the local party commissar, and neither of them knew who among their staff was an NKVD informer. A testimony to the effectiveness of the system is that modern totalitarianism largely solved the perennial problem of pre-modern autocracies, revolts by provincial subordinates. While the USSR had its share of court coups, not once did a provincial governor or a Red Army front commander rebel against the center. Much of the credit for that goes to the secret police, which kept a close eye on the mass of citizens, on provincial administrators, and even more so on the party and the Red Army. While in most polities throughout history, the army had wielded enormous political power, in 20th century totalitarian regimes, the regular army ceded much of its clout to the secret police, the information army. In the USSR, the Cheka, OGPU, NKVD, and KGB lacked the firepower of the Red Army, but had more influence in the Kremlin and could terrorize and purge even the army brass. The East German Stasi and the Romanian Securitate were similarly stronger than the regular armies of these countries. In Nazi Germany, the SS was more powerful than the Wehrmacht, and the SS chief, Heinrich Himmler, was higher up the pecking order than Wilhelm Keitel, chief of the Wehrmacht High Command. In none of these cases could the secret police defeat the regular army in traditional warfare, of course. What made the secret police powerful was its command of information. It had the information necessary to preempt a military coup and to arrest the commanders of tank brigades or fighter squadrons before they knew what hit them. During the Stalinist Great Terror of the late 1930s, out of 144,000 Red Army officers, about 10% were shot or imprisoned by the NKVD. This included 154 of 186 divisional commanders, 83%, 8 of 9 admirals, 89%, 13 of 15 full generals, 87%, and 3 of 5 marshals, 60%. The party leadership fared just as badly. Of the revered old Bolsheviks, people who joined the party before the 1917 revolution, about a third didn't survive the Great Terror. Of the 33 men who served on the Politburo between 1919 and 1938, 14 were shot, 42%. Of the 139 members and candidate members of the party's Central Committee in 1934, 98, 70%, were shot. Only 2% of the delegates who took part in the 17th Party Congress in 1934 evaded execution, imprisonment, expulsion, or demotion, and attended the 18th Party Congress in 1939. The secret police, which did all the purging and killing, was itself divided into several competing branches that closely watched and purged one another. Genrikh Jagoda, the NKVD head who orchestrated the beginning of the Great Terror and supervised the killing of hundreds of thousands of victims, was executed in 1938 and replaced by Nikolai Yeshov. Yeshov lasted for 2 years, killing and imprisoning millions of people before being executed in 1940. Perhaps most telling is the fate of the 39 people who in 1935 held the rank of general in the NKVD, called Commissars of State Security in Soviet nomenclature. 35 of them, 90%, were arrested and shot by 1941. One was assassinated, and one, the head of the NKVD's Far East Regional Office, saved himself by defecting to Japan, but was killed by the Japanese in 1945. Of the original cohort of 39 NKVD generals, only 2 men were left standing by the end of World War II. The remorseless logic of totalitarianism eventually caught up with them too. During the power struggles that followed Stalin's death in 1953, one of them was shot, while the other was consigned to a psychiatric hospital, where he died in 1960. Serving as an NKVD general in Stalin's day was one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. At a time when American democracy was improving its many self-correcting mechanisms, Soviet totalitarianism was refining its triple self-surveilling and self-terrorizing apparatus. Total control. Totalitarian regimes are based on controlling the flow of information and are suspicious of any independent channels of information. When military officers, state officials, or ordinary citizens exchange information, they can build trust. If they come to trust one another, they can organize resistance to the regime. Therefore, a key tenet of totalitarian regimes is that wherever people meet and exchange information, the regime should be there too, to keep an eye on them. In the 1930s, this was one principle that Hitler and Stalin shared. On March 31, 1933, 2 months after Hitler became Chancellor, the Nazis passed the Coordination Act, Gleichschaltungsgesetz. This stipulated that by April 30, 1933, all political, social and cultural organizations throughout Germany, from municipalities to football clubs and local choirs, must be run according to Nazi ideology, as organs of the Nazi state. It upended life in every city and hamlet in Germany. For example, in the small Alpine village of Oberstdorf, the democratically elected municipal council met for the last time on April 21, 1933. And 3 days later, it was replaced by an unelected Nazi council that appointed a Nazi mayor. Since the Nazis alone allegedly knew what the people really wanted, who other than Nazis could implement the people's will? Oberstdorf also had about 50 associations and clubs, ranging from a beekeeping society to an alpinist club. They all had to conform to the Coordination Act, adjusting their boards, membership, and statutes to Nazi demands, hoisting the swastika flag, and concluding every meeting with the Horst Wessel song, the Nazi Party's anthem. On April 6, 1933, the Oberstdorf Fishing Society banned Jews from its ranks. None of the 32 members was Jewish, but they felt they had to prove their Aryan credentials to the new regime. Things were even more extreme in Stalin's USSR. Whereas the Nazis still allowed church organizations and private businesses some partial freedom of action, the Soviets made no exceptions. By 1928 and the launch of the first five-year plan, there were government officials, party functionaries and secret police informants in every neighborhood and village, and between them they controlled every aspect of life. All businesses from power plants to cabbage farms, all newspapers and radio stations, all universities, schools and youth groups, all hospitals and clinics, all voluntary and religious organizations, all sporting and scientific associations, all parks, museums and cinemas. If a dozen people came together to play football, hike in the woods or do some charity work, the party and the secret police had to be there too, represented by the local party cell or NKVD agent. The speed and efficiency of modern information technology meant that all these party cells and NKVD agents were always just a telegram or phone call away from Moscow. Information about suspicious persons and activities was fed into a countrywide, cross-referenced system of card catalogues. Known as kartoteki, these catalogues contained information from work records, police files, residence cards, and other forms of social registrations, and, by the 1930s, had become the primary mechanism for surveilling and controlling the Soviet population. This made it feasible for Stalin to seek control over the totality of Soviet life. One crucial example was the campaign to collectivize Soviet farming. For centuries, economic, social, and private life in the thousands of villages of the sprawling Tsarist Empire was managed by several traditional institutions: the local commune, the parish church, the private farm, the local market, and above all, the family. In the mid-1920s, the Soviet Union was still an overwhelmingly agrarian economy. About 82% of the total population lived in villages, and 83% of the workforce was engaged in farming. But if each peasant family made its own decisions about what to grow, what to buy, and how much to charge for their produce, it greatly limited the ability of Moscow officials to themselves plan and control social and economic activities. What if the officials decided on a major agrarian reform, but the peasant families rejected it? So, when in 1928 the Soviets came up with their first five-year plan for the development of the Soviet Union, the most important item on the agenda was to collectivize farming. The idea was that in every village, all the families would join a kolkhoz, a collective farm. They would hand over to the kolkhoz all their property: land, houses, horses, cows, shovels, pitchforks. They would work together for the kolkhoz, and in return, the kolkhoz would provide for all their needs, from housing and education to food and healthcare. The Kolkhoz would also decide, based on orders from Moscow, whether they should grow cabbages or turnips, whether to invest in a tractor or a school, and who would work in the dairy farm, the tannery, and the clinic. The result, thought the Moscow masterminds, would be the first perfectly just and equal society in human history. They were similarly convinced of the economic advantages of their proposed system, thinking that the Kolkhoz would enjoy economy of scale. For example, when every peasant family had but a small strip of land, it made little sense to buy a tractor to plough it, and in any case, most families couldn't afford a tractor. Once all land was held communally, it could be cultivated far more efficiently using modern machinery. In addition, the Kolkhoz was supposed to benefit from the wisdom of modern science. Instead of every peasant deciding on production methods on the basis of old traditions and groundless superstitions, state experts with university degrees from institutions like the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences would make the crucial decisions. To the planners in Moscow, it sounded wonderful. They expected a 50% increase in agricultural production by 1931, and if in the process the old village hierarchies and inequalities were bulldozed, all the better. To most peasants, however, it sounded terrible. They didn't trust the Moscow planners or the new Kolkhoz system. They did not want to give up their old way of life or their private property. Villagers slaughtered cows and horses instead of handing them to the Kolkhoz. Their motivation to work dwindled. People made less effort ploughing fields that belonged to everyone than ploughing fields that belonged to their own family. Passive resistance was ubiquitous, sometimes flaring into violent clashes. Whereas Soviet planners expected to harvest 98 million tons of grain in 1931, production was only 69 million, according to official data, and might have been as low as 57 million tons in reality. The 1932 harvest was even worse. The state reacted with fury. Between 1929 and 1936, food confiscation, government neglect, and man-made famines, resulting from government policy rather than a natural disaster, claimed the lives of between 4.5 and 8.5 million people. Millions of additional peasants were declared enemies of the state and deported or imprisoned. The most basic institutions of peasant life, the family, the church, the local community, were terrorized and dismantled. In the name of justice, equality, and the will of the people, the collectivization campaign annihilated anything that stood in its way. In the first 2 months of 1930 alone, about 60 million peasants in more than 100,000 villages were herded into collective farms. In June 1929, only 4% of Soviet peasant households had belonged to collective farms. By March 1930, the figure had risen to 57%. By April 1937, 97% of households in the countryside had been confined to the 235,000 Soviet collective farms. In just 7 years, then, a way of life that has existed for centuries had been replaced by the totalitarian brainchild of a few Moscow bureaucrats. The Kulaks. It is worthwhile to delve a little deeper into the history of Soviet collectivization, for it was a tragedy that bears some resemblance to earlier catastrophes in human history, like the European witch hunt craze, and at the same time foreshadows some of the biggest dangers posed by 21st century technology and its faith in supposedly scientific data. When their efforts to collectivize farming encountered resistance and led to economic disaster, Moscow bureaucrats and mythmakers took a page from Kramer's Hammer of the Witches. I don't wish to imply that the Soviets actually read the book, but they too invented a global conspiracy and created an entire non-existent category of enemies. In the 1930s, Soviet authorities repeatedly blamed the disasters afflicting the Soviet economy on a counter-revolutionary cabal whose chief agents were the kulaks, or capitalist farmers. Just as in Kramer's imagination, witches serving Satan conjured hailstorms that destroyed crops, so in the Stalinist imagination, kulaks beholden to global capitalism sabotaged the Soviet economy. In theory, kulaks were an objective socio-economic category defined by analyzing empirical data on things like property, income, capital, and wages. Soviet officials could allegedly identify kulaks by counting things. If most people in a village had only one cow, then the few families who had three cows were considered kulaks. If most people in a village didn't hire any labor, but one family hired two workers during harvest time, this was a kulak family. Being a kulak meant not only that you possessed a certain amount of property, but also that you possessed certain personality traits. According to the supposedly infallible Marxist doctrine, people's material conditions determined their social and spiritual character. Since kulaks allegedly engaged in capitalist exploitation, it was a scientific fact, according to Marxist thinking, that they were greedy, selfish, and unreliable, and so were their children. Discovering that someone was a kulak ostensibly revealed something profound about their fundamental nature. On December 27, 1929, Stalin declared that the Soviet state should seek the liquidation of the kulaks as a class, and immediately galvanized the party and the secret police to realize that ambitious and murderous aim. Early modern European witch hunters worked in autocratic societies that lacked modern information technology. Therefore, it took them 3 centuries to kill 50,000 alleged witches. In contrast, Soviet kulak hunters were working in a totalitarian society that had at its disposal technologies such as telegraphs, trains, telephones, and radios, as well as a sprawling bureaucracy. They decided that 2 years would suffice to liquidate millions of kulaks. Soviet officials began by assessing how many kulaks there must be in the USSR. Based on existing data, such as tax records, employment records, and the 1926 Soviet census, they decided that kulaks constituted 3 to 5% of the rural population. On January 30, 1930, just 1 month after Stalin's speech, a Politburo decree translated his vague vision into a much more detailed plan of action. The decree included target numbers for the liquidation of kulaks in each major agricultural region. Regional authorities then made their own estimates of the number of kulaks in each county under their jurisdiction. Eventually, specific quotas were assigned to rural Soviets, local administrative units typically comprising a handful of villages. Often, local officials inflated the numbers along the way to prove their zeal. Each rural Soviet then had to identify the stated number of kulak households in the villages under its purview. These people were expelled from their homes and, according to the administrative category to which they belonged, resettled elsewhere, incarcerated in concentration camps, or condemned to death. How exactly did Soviet officials tell who was a kulak? In some villages, local party members made a conscientious effort to identify kulaks by objective measures, such as the amount of property they owned. It was often the most hard-working and efficient farmers who were stigmatized and expelled. In some villages, local communists used the opportunity to get rid of their personal enemies. Some villages simply drew lots on who would be considered a kulak. Other villages held communal meetings to vote on the matter, and often chose isolated farmers, widows, old people, and other expendables, exactly the sorts of people who in early modern Europe were most likely to be branded witches. The absurdity of the entire operation is manifested in the case of the Streletsky family from the Kurgan region of Siberia. Dmitry Streletsky, who was then a teenager, record years later how his family was branded kulaks and selected for liquidation. Serkov, the chairman of the village Soviet who deported us, explained, "I have received an order from the district party committee to find 17 kulak families for deportation. I formed